Yeah, it's very nice to be asked to come here and give these talks. I have a long association with the LBC. I was here 10 years very intensively before I went to Te Papamoeka, and I fundraised, and I even put in some sash cords upstairs in Sukhavati, and it was being built under Attila's directions. Yeah, a long association with the LBC. It's a great centre. I also have a long association with Milarepa, which predates my involvement with the FWBO. So I began to think of myself, or call myself, a Buddhist back in the dark ages of the middle, late 60s. And one of the things that was different about then and now, lots of things are different, but one of the things that's different is nowadays there are so many Dharma books available, so much Dharma available, so many translations, so many texts, so many books. Not to mention CDs, DVDs, podcasts, Buddhist radio, internet, you know. It's just amazing. Well, in those days, there was very, very few books that had been translated, very few things available. And I came across four books called the Tibetan series, edited by a man called Evan Wendt. Some of you may have heard of him. Those books are still available. I think he first edited them in the 30s, and they were still in print when I came along, as it were. And so they were the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation, now known as Seeing with Naked Awareness, Padmasambhava's text. Tibetan Yoga and Secret Doctrines, which was a very strange book, nearly put me off. And Tibet's Great Yogi, Milarepa, which I still have the book. I meant to bring it tonight, but I still have my copy of that book. And then, of course, in the 60s, the 100,000 Songs of Milarepa came out as well, that translation. So yeah, those books had a very big effect on me. I was very drawn to Tibetan Buddhism and very drawn to Milarepa. And I have to say that for quite a long time, I found it much easier to relate to Milarepa than I did to the Buddha. Milarepa's closer in time, he's only 1,000 years ago as opposed to 2,500 years ago. And I suppose the story of Milarepa is so human, isn't it? He had a tough start, he had difficult beginnings, he had to turn his life around. So, you know, I could relate to that. I think the Buddha was more remote historically and, well, much more remote spiritually. So Milarepa comes across in the life of Milarepa and in the 100,000 Songs as very, very human. It says on the back of one copy of The Life, "The Life is not just a biography, but a powerful and graphic folktale full of magic, disaster, feuds, deception and humour," which I think is very true. So yes, he really needed to, he did these awful things that I'm going to tell you about, and he really needed to turn his life around, so I think that was quite easy for me to relate to. The life of Milarepa is a great story. It's a great and tragic story. It's a dramatic story, and it's not surprising it's been made into a couple of films. I think there's a new film coming out soon called Milarepa Revenge. Which will come on to revenge. Yes. And it's also made into a comic. You've got the comic cartoon in your library here. Look it out. It's very good. And so the life of Milarepa and the songs of Milarepa, they tell us a lot about him, his own experience and all the people he came into contact with. And through reading the life and the songs, you just get a sense that the people's concerns, their faults, their failings, their upsets, their unhappiness, their struggles, their aspiration, their practice, even though it was 11th century Tibet, it wasn't that different than people are today, really. And especially in the life, Milarepa seems to run the whole gamut of human emotions. He expresses his life very, very dramatically and emotionally. And he's often weeping, he's often in despair. He has a terrible time, really. And it's not just him, it's everybody in the life and in the songs. The Tibetans at that time, I don't know about now so much, but they all seem to feel and express their emotions very, very strongly. So there's no sort of stiff upper lip. And I think that had a great impact on me. So it's very, very vivid and very engaging story. There's no holding back. So I think it's great that in this session, in this class, we are studying Milarepa. He is Tibet's great yogi. He's perhaps Buddhism's greatest yogi. He's perhaps the world's greatest yogi. And he's on our refuge tree for that reason. And he's famous, isn't he? He's famous for turning his life around from doing these terribly dark deeds to gain enlightenment in one life. He's famous for his radical renunciation, living on nettles. I discovered reading some of the text a bit more closely, but he also ate leeks, so it wasn't quite so bad. Leeks and nettles. But he is famous for the radical renunciation and the simple life. But that radical renunciation and the simple life that he leads is always conjoined with joy, with naturalness, with spontaneity and freedom. So it's a very lovely balance. He's famous for his devotion to his guru, to Marpa, that we've heard about in a previous class. He's the great exemplar of guru yoga, and I'm going to explore that later on in the next talk. And I think perhaps most of all, he exemplifies intensity of practice, commitment to practice. And in terms of his own teaching, once he's realised, he's a great singer of the Dharma, but I think there's probably not a song in Minarepa where he doesn't express the teaching of impermanence in some way or other. And he does that very beautifully. He does it through natural images. And, you know, he loves the natural world in which he lives. He does it through beautiful metaphors and similes. And he does it by just communicating very directly to people about their own impermanence. So you can't escape that central fundamental teaching of Buddhism if you read the songs in Minarepa. But it's very engaging, so it's sometimes impermanence seems a bit kind of hard, doesn't it? But I think you just can't escape it with Minarepa, and you just go with it to a certain extent. He's also famous for his voice, the fact that he sang the Dharma with a beautiful voice. And apparently he did have a lovely voice, said to be as sweet and equal to the voice of Manjushri, the great Bodhisattva of wisdom. His voice was said to be the voice of the natural Vajra sound, a Dharma rainfall of speech. So this very beautiful voice. And sometimes the songs of Milarepa are referred to as songs on the spot, which I quite like, because they were completely spontaneous. So his enlightened songs, he doesn't go away and write them like me, you know, write a talk and think about it in the bath. It was just in the moment, completely spontaneous, completely in response to whoever was in front of him. Or sometimes he just sang because he wanted to sing for himself. So completely spontaneous, not rehearsed in any way, and just coming from the depths of his enlightened experience, his spiritual experience, and from the depths of his heart. Apparently he could sing, he was born with a beautiful voice, but he could sing in that way, the Dharma spontaneously. It was one of his spiritual attainments, one of his siddhis. But it's also part of his tradition and lineage. I think if you've been at the other talks, Tilopa, Naropa, Marpa, they all sing the Dharma. But Milarepa once said, in comparison to five other realised yogis, that those who sang spontaneous songs of the Dharma, he was the best. So he sang to all kinds of people that he met in Tibet at that time. He sang for his supper, he sang in answer to questions, he sang in answer to challenge. His songs are full of beautiful natural images. They contain both very simple and profound Dharma teachings. He was direct. He certainly didn't beat about the bush in what he sang or said. He was uncompromising. He was challenging. He was provocative. And he was also kind. And his purpose was always to wake people up, to get people on the path of the Dharma, or to take them further on their Dharma path. See, he's perhaps most famous for his songs, for singing the Dharma. So there is a lot of material on Milarepa. There's the life, there's the 100,000 songs, which I don't know if there are actually 100,000, but there's a lot of songs, a lot of Dharma material. And there's a couple of other books, Drinking the Mountain Stream and Miraculous Journey, containing other songs. So tonight I'm going to explore Milarepa's life. Now you may be very, very familiar with the life of Milarepa. I don't know. It is quite a well-known story in Buddhist circles. And you're probably familiar with the way Milarepa looks. Often he's depicted sitting at sort of at ease, sometimes whitish, sometimes greenish because of the nettles and the leeks. And sometimes with his hand to his ear singing. But he's, you know, always very relaxed in a white cloth, and often with this red meditation band. Kagyu practitioners tend to have a band that keeps their knees in place as they meditate. So you may be familiar with the life, but I'd like us to stand in Milarepa's shoes, but he didn't wear shoes presumably very much, but kind of stand in his shoes, as it were, metaphorically. And though his life may be very different from our own, there are lots of episodes and aspects of the life which we can relate to, which we can resonate with. And I like us to approach the life in that sort of way, so we kind of don't just think, oh, we know the story and it has a happy ending. It's all great, isn't it? That, you know, we just kind of try and get inside the experience of the life. So the life arises from a dream of Rachungpa, one of Manarepa's foremost disciples, who has a dream and then asks Manarepa to tell his life, which he does, and then presumably it was an oral recounting for a while and then eventually gets written down. So Manarepa tells his life. And he starts with a bit of background in his family, and one of the things that you learn is that his great-grandfather and his grandfather moved to the village where Manarepa was born. So a sort of generation or so back, they lost all their money and they moved and then they made money again. But maybe if you've ever lived in the country, you know, they would be incomers because they've only been there, you know, like a couple of generations. living out in Wales, I know what that's like, you know, you're an incomer. So I think there was a little bit of envy there already with the family. They hadn't been there like for centuries. However, Milarepa's father inherits the wealth. There's a house, there's land, there's animals, he trades. So they're quite wealthy. And he marries a woman called White Jewel. And she was said, and this is said in the life of Milarepa, and this is interesting, so bear this in mind. She was said to be a skillful housekeeper and as extreme in her love for her friends as she was in hatred for her enemies. So that will arise later. So also there's another branch of the family. They're referred to as an uncle and aunt. They're not exactly an uncle and aunt, but there's another branch of the family with a lot of children. And the wife's sister, they hear about the wealth of Manarepa's father and they move to the village, so quite a large branch of the family move to the village, and it said they were dependent on Manarepa's family. So there's another kind of source of envy there. So Manarepa was born in 1052. His family name was Mila, and he was called Delightful to Hear. So presumably there was a hope or an understanding that he would have a lovely voice, which of course he did. He has a sister born 4 years later. He was also engaged as a child to someone called Sese, which apparently was the tradition. And he says he was raised with love and heard only gentle voices. So he had a happy, prosperous childhood. Presumably the family were rich and kind of central in the village life, looked up to, popular. But when he was seven, disaster struck. So his father becomes ill, eventually dying. Which is very tragic to lose your father at seven, and for the wife to lose her husband. Very tragic. But the father manages to get his affairs in order before he dies, and he gathers the aunt and uncle and all their family, all the villagers, all the neighbours, and there's a will in which he leaves all his wealth in trust to the aunt and uncle for Manarepa when he comes of age. But unfortunately, as soon as he dies, the aunt and uncle seize all the property. They don't keep their word, they seize all the property. They reduce Manarepa and his mother and sister to be practically slaves. And Manarepa says, when he's telling his life story, our food was only fit for dogs. We worked like donkeys or mules. We wore rags. We had no rest and we became pale and emaciated. Our once lovely hair became sparse and grey. In short, we were treated like slaves. The uncle beat him and the aunt had a terrible temper. And people sympathetic to the family were too frightened of the uncle and all his sons, big family, to do anything about it. So you have a huge shock, a huge sort of reverse of fortune, don't you, from being sort of the family in the village and all this wealth, you lose everything. So it's enough to lose your father, but then you've lost everything. You've lost your reputation, you've lost everything. You've been happy and wealthy and popular, and you just lose it all. So you've been exposed to huge betrayal by family members, which is also a shock, and you've been reduced to slavery. So these things happen to people, don't they? This happens to people every day. It's happening as we speak to people. So it's not an unusual situation, although this is quite dramatic. So we could think about that. We could think it's not unusual. There's a reversal of fortune. It's loss and gain. In this case, it's gain and loss, isn't it? It's samsara's wheel sort of turning. But it's unexpected. It's shocking. So maybe think of a time in your life when you were kind of happily cruising along in life, things were going well, and then things change. It could be something that happens to you, it could be something that happens to your family, it could be something that happens in your country. It's just unexpected. What did that feel like? What was that like? How did you respond? you know, how, what happened. So just, you know, try and get inside that experience of quite a shock and quite a lot of loss, so that we kind of understand a little bit more what happens in Minarepa's family. So this goes on for 8 years, this kind of slavery and rough treatment and hard work and no food, no clothes. So Minarepa comes of age when he's 15. And the mother manages, she's got a brother who's not very wealthy, but he's got a field. She manages, with his help, to gather some provisions together for a coming-of-age feast, and she invites everybody. And this is going to be a rereading of the will. So she's trying to get justice. There's no civil justice in this country, so you have to rely on trust, and you have to rely on people's word, and that's been broken, hasn't it? So there's no sheriff riding into town either, unfortunately. So she tries to put it right. She gets everyone together and says, well, now is the time to give everything back to Minarepa. And the aunt and uncle say, no, it was never yours in the first place. You only borrowed it, and, you know, it's we are the rightful owners of everything, so no. And they beat them and throw them out of the house. And they say, it's interesting, if you are many, make an army. If you are few, make magic. So they kind of invite, to some extent, what happens later. So, you know, again, it's very, very hard, particularly for the mother who sort of tried to get things right. But Minarepa's of age, so he gets a job. He's working, he can read, so he's working reading texts with someone. And one day, not quite sure how long after his coming of age this happens, but he's been out with his master and they've drunk some chang, Tibetan beer, very strong stuff, apparently. And he's a bit drunk on his way home, and he's singing. So he probably hasn't, he's got this lovely voice, he's called delightful to hear, but he probably hasn't sung for years. So, you know, the alcohol's kind of loosened up his inhibitions a bit and made him forget he's so unhappy. He's singing, and his mother hears him singing, and she comes out of the house, and she is beside herself with rage and fury and grief, and she throws ash over him, she beats him with a broomstick, and she says, how can you sing? How can you sing when we are so wretched? And of course then he's really upset. He's a very strong relationship with his mother. And the sister comes out and what's happening, so they're all kind of weeping and wailing and, you know, desperate. And it's at this point that the mother, obviously, she cannot bear it any longer. She wants revenge. And she says that to Minarepa, I want you to learn magic. I want you to be able to curse the aunt and uncle, the neighbours and the villagers, down to the ninth generation. So this is heavy stuff, isn't it? And in despair and with lamenting, Minarepa says, I will do whatever you want. I will do whatever you want. He's 15, 16, 17. He's quite young. So there's a plan that he's going to go off and learn black magic with a teacher to learn how to wreak this vengeance. And there's other young men going to learn a bit of magic. Rabbits out of hats and things, maybe, I don't know. Anyway, it's set up, and the mother says to the companions, Minarepa has no willpower. It's fascinating, isn't it? Who he becomes later, he's got no willpower. You've got to kind of keep him at it. And when he's leaving Minarepa, she says, you've got to have indomitable will, and if you come back and you haven't done it, I will kill myself in front of you. So, that is kind of heavy stuff, isn't it? It's really heavy stuff. She's a sort of Lady Macbeth of the piece, isn't she? So it's the kind of ultimate emotional blackmail, isn't it? Emotional pressure, terrible kind of pressure to be under. And so there's two things in here, I think, to explore a little bit in terms of, well, you know, what would that be like? Maybe we've never been in a situation quite like that. But so Minarepa, first of all, I think he's between a rock and a hard place, isn't he? You know, he loves his mother. He's suffered along with her. He's seen her suffer. He's had all that hardship. And she says, if you don't do this, I'm going to kill myself. So most of us, I think, placed in that situation where someone we love threatens suicide, we're not going to risk, call their bluff, are we? We're not going to, maybe they're hard to do that. So he doesn't want that to happen. So he's in a very difficult situation. And so maybe try and think of a situation that you've been in where you kind of feel under some sort of oppression or emotional pressure, and you've got to make some kind of choice. You've got to act in some way. And was it Hobson's choice? I don't know who Hobson was, but anyway, presumably Hobson had two tough choices. You know who Hobson was. Tell me later.
Hobson ran a
So I've sort of seen that as a, you know, a tough decision. You've got two choices. You haven't got a big perspective. You kind of think, I'm in this place, you know, this really hard place. I've got to act, and you choose one. You go with one. And what do you do to go with one? Because neither of them may be very positive or skillful. You kind of, don't you, kind of, like that. And you do it. And in the process of doing that, you cut off from, you put aside, you repress your softer, gentler, sensitive, feelingful emotions, your conscience. You know, you just have to put that aside. I mean, I've been in a place like that in my life. And I think what happens is you do that to make the decision. And you've made the decision, you've acted, actions have consequences. The consequences are in you. And all those feelings, unless you're a complete psychopath, all those feelings come flooding back. You know, those small sensitive feelings, and you feel a lot of pain, a lot of grief, a lot of remorse. So just think, have I been in a situation where I just had really tough choices and I went with one of those choices and it wasn't very good? Sometimes those painful experiences are what brings us to the Dharma. So there's a kind of silver lining or something, isn't there? Which is true in my case. So Mirarep is in this very, very tough decision. He's under this extreme emotional pressure. He loves his mum, so he's going to do it. And his mother is in a very unskillful mental state, isn't she? She's kind of had all this suffering. She's probably been brooding and resentful for a long time. And she wants revenge. And I can sort of sympathise with her, really. She's had a tough time, so I can sympathise. But you can't condone, you know, what she sets in train. So I think revenge is an interesting human emotion. It's a desire, isn't it, for retaliation, for wrongdoing or hurt. And there is a kind of justice in it. I suppose some societies run on, don't they, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, that kind of justice from a more objective point of view. It's kind of got a balance. And I think we're familiar with revenge cultures. And the mafia is a famous revenge culture, isn't it? And there are revenge cultures going on as we speak. And there are places where there are rival groups of people caught in conflict and, you know, things kind of spiral out of control, don't they? You get into blood feud and vendetta. So you kill my son, I'll kill yours. You bomb my village, I'll bomb your village. So you get the sense of where revenge can go. On a personal level, I think revenge, the feeling of revenge or desire for revenge arises often within the family or very, very close relationships. I think it's James Hillman who says, you only feel betrayed, and betrayal could lead you to a desire for revenge, where you've really trusted. So very close relationships, often, unfortunately, in the sexual romantic relationship, because you've trusted, you open yourself, so it's very easy to feel betrayed and then desire revenge. I put revenge in Google. It's a bit scary, actually. These kind of websites came up. Don't go there. Don't do this at home, children. Don't do it. But anyway, it's interesting. So yes, so revenge is, I think, is a kind of instinctual thing that, you know, your ego, it's to do with the ego, isn't it? Our ego is so kind of sensitive and so easily hurt and offended and so on, that the instinctual response is to want to kind of rewrite the balance somewhere. You know, you've lost your power, you've been disempowered, so you want to kind of get that back in some way. I think the same as blame, you know, blame and revenge, betrayal. Lovely combination. They all go together. So I think, you know, revenge is a kind of natural, this instinctual response for the ego to be hurt or put down in some way. Her desire for revenge is very, very strong. It's not exactly proportional, is it? Because often revenge, you think, well, you know, you do this and I'll do that. But maybe to her feeling of hurt was so strong that it felt proportional. She's sort of become revenge, isn't she? She's kind of become that mental state. And along with that, she's fallen prey to all kinds of other negative mental states under that sort of umbrella of hatred. Anger, hatred, cruelty, delight in cruelty, malice, spite, and later on she expresses cunning and deceit. So yes, very negative mental states that she's kind of caught up in. So we might think, well, this is all a bit much, we're nice Buddhists, we don't feel revenge. And if we do admit to such feelings, then they're very hard to admit to, I think. We wouldn't act on them, of course, we wouldn't. Because any expression of revenge, malice, hatred, cruelty, you know, obviously goes completely against the principles on which we've based our life. It's completely against the precepts, completely against the first precept, against the love mode, against forgiveness, against the Bodhisattva ideal to help all sentient beings, to cherish all beings. But interestingly enough, in a text called the 7-Point Mind Training, which is a training for trainee and novice Bodhisattvas, there are a number of aphorisms and precepts, and one of them is, don't lie in ambush. So this shows you that even a novice trainee Bodhisattva, the clever person who wrote the text, thinks, well, you know, you may fall into that mental state. But I think it's a very interesting way of putting it, don't lie in ambush. And I suppose that might relate to the quote, revenge is a dish best served cold. Because there's the implication that we've been hurt in some way, we've lost our power, we nurse our grudge, we wait, we scheme, we plot, we plan. And when our opponent is blissfully, they think we've got over it. They're blissfully unaware. Their guard is down, they're vulnerable. Then we strike, we ambush. So do we do that? Of course not. Of course not. But do we do that? Even in very small ways. You know, just think about, you know, your own life and so on and so forth. I mean, sometimes somebody can say the mildest thing to us, can't they? It's not even a criticism. Your best friend can just make a passing comment and you're offended in some way. You know, the ego is so easily kind of offended, and it's a little, sometimes a little thought, you know, you'll get them back in some way. It might be that they don't ring you, they don't call you, and you just think, well, I won't call them. So we have those kind of thoughts, they're very subtle, so maybe we don't go very far with them, but just think about, you know, that area of life, about revenge. Have you been involved in that in your life? Do you still fall prey to resentment? You know, what is your involvement with this kind of negative mental states? I mean, I learned to lie in ambush as a child because I had an elder brother who teased me and did all kinds of things. And I was very tiny. And, you know, I would wait until he was unsuspecting. Would in some way or other get my own back, and then I'd be sent to bed, and I think that's not fair. Anyway, when I read this line, I thought, oh, I know that one. So, yeah, think about revenge, and, you know, I suppose even if it's very subtle, trying to admit to it, because it's one of those kind of uncomfortable emotions like envy or jealousy or blame, isn't it, to admit to. Just admit to it, even if it's very subtle, and try and kind of let go of it or apply an antidote. So Milarepa goes off with his promise to his mother to learn magic, and the first year they don't really learn that much, so he asks to stay on with the teacher to really learn to wreak this vengeance. And what happens is that he does learn how to do it, and the aunt and uncle and all their family are having a wedding party for one of the sons, and they're in the house, except the aunt and uncle, and except a number of people who are sympathetic to Milarepa, because magic works like that. And the magic, in some way, stirs up the animals around the house. So the animals stampede, and the house falls down and kills 35 people. Now, again, I think when we know the life of Milarepa, we kind of think, well, that wasn't very good. But he gets enlightened, so that's all right. But, I mean, it's a huge thing to cause the death of 35 people. It's really not insignificant, is it? I mean, these days, forget the magic, if you know, somebody did that, we'd think, well, you know, put him in maximum security, throw away the key, they're a monster. It's a terrible thing. It's just people he knew in his village, relations, neighbours, friends. So he causes that to happen. And the teacher who's working with him says to Milarepa, the aunt and uncle are still alive. Do you want them dead as well? And he says, no, leave them alive so that they know my vengeance and my justice. So Milarepa is not completely innocent. He's not just under the sway of his mother. He has his own part in this. So it's a big crime with a big, it's a weighty karma, isn't it? It's a big thing to have done. And it gets worse because Milarepa's mother hears this, she knows it's happened, somebody comes and tells her, and she is overjoyed. Not really joy, but she's kind of gloating that, you know, another extremely unskillful mental event, that this has happened to her enemies. And people who sympathise with her, you know, they're kind of, this is just too much, this is going too far. And the uncle is beside himself, of course, because he's lost his family and all his friends. He wants to kill her. He wants to torture her and rip her heart out. So you can see, you know, again, this one unskillful act, one kind of cruel, murderous act could provoke another. But the villagers say if they kill her, Minnerepa will just wreak more vengeance. So basically they have to kill him. But Minnerepa's mother, she's very clever. She manages to send a secret letter to Minnerepa and say, our lives are under threat. You've got to wreak more vengeance. You've got to send a hailstorm and destroy all the crops in the village. And she forges a letter from Minnerepa that gets known in the village that says, if anybody harms her or her daughter, you know, they'll be in for it. So she falls prey to scheming and deceit as well. So he does come and he does destroy the crop. He has to come close to the village to do that, and you know, people are after him, and he has to escape with his life back to his teacher. So he doesn't see his mother. From that point he left to go and learn the magic. He doesn't see his mother again. So there's a lot of loss in Minnerepa's life. So after a while he starts to feel remorse. All those feelings, those sensitive feelings of the ethical feelings, the conscience, start to flood back. And, you know, I think that can be our experience. You know, as I said, we do something that we did kind of under pressure and it was unskillful. We regret it and we feel remorse. So remorse in Buddhism is it's an interesting emotion. It's a positive and painful mental event. So most positive mental events are pleasurable, but remorse is positive, because it shows that you regret what you've done, but you feel it as a painful evasion, as a painful experience. And it can be very painful indeed, because you can't just, you know, you realise what you've done. You can't just sort it out. What's done is done. What you've done, you've done. And we can't just forget it. It, you know, preys on our minds, it preys on our feelings, unless you choose to numb it with drink or drugs or something like that. So in The Winter's Tale, Shakespeare's play, The Winter's Tale, if you know the play, the tragedy happens in the first two acts. Someone is obsessed, the king is obsessed by jealousy. He thinks his wife is having an affair with a friend. It's completely untrue, but he's so overcome by this negative feeling that the friend has to flee. He puts the pregnant wife in jail. They already have a son. The son dies of shock because his mum's in jail. The baby's born and he sends the baby off to die. And the wife, knowing both those things, dies of shock. So, you know, there's this huge kind of negative feeling. And then it's kind of a disaster, really. And then he sort of comes to and he's sorry. And his wife's friend says, well, you know, okay, you're sorry, but, you know, that's not enough. She says, do not repent these things, for they are heavier than all thy woes can stir. Therefore betake thee to nothing but despair. 1,000 knees, 10,000 years together, naked, fasting upon a barren mountain. That's what he has to do. And other people say, well, that's a bit strong. Yeah. And and the king says, no, she speaks the truth, and I will visit the temple where they lie once a day, and grieve until I die. So there's a sort of sense that you can kind of understand that you've done something very unskillful, and you can regret it, but there's a process that you need to go through of remorse, of grief, of understanding the effect it's had on others, the effect it's had on you, understanding in the context of, you know, deeper and deeper understanding of ethical principles. And in Shakespeare, of course, it takes a good 15 years usually to sort those sort of things out. And Minnerepa says, I deeply repented the destruction and mischief I had done by magic and killing so many people and creating hailstorms. I so longed for the Dharma that I forgot to eat. When I was sitting down, I wanted to be standing. When I was standing, I wanted to be sitting. At night, I was unable to sleep. I was full of remorse and repentance. So it's a very strong expression of that feeling of, you know, he's so restless, isn't he? So kind of troubled, his mind oppressed with wretchedness, trouble and fear. He's troubled in his mind, he can't sit still, he can't sleep, he can't eat. So he does know something about the Dharma. He lives in a Buddhist country, and he does have an understanding of karma. You gather that he does. And he knows, now he's kind of in this remorse phase, that unless he gains enlightenment, unless he finds the Dharma and gains enlightenment in this life, he's going to go to a hell realm for a very, very, very long time. That's the tradition in which he's been raised. So he's, you know, just trying to imagine that kind of mental state. He's in severe anguish. And he can't tell his teacher because it seems to be the practice at the time, he's committed to serve his teacher, so he feels he can't tell his teacher. But luckily his teacher, this is a black magic teacher, also starts to feel remorse because he's taught people black magic and he's also caused harm himself. And they agree between them that Milarepa will go in search of the Dharma for both of them. So he goes off to a Nyingma teacher who has a quick path of liberation. You just meditate and then meditate at night. It's going to be quick. And if you've got good karma and you're gifted, you don't even have to meditate. You just have to hear the teaching and you'll be liberated. And this is so interesting. Milarepa, who's been in the depths of despair and remorse and anguish, thinks, oh, maybe I'm gifted. I've got good karma. I don't need to do this practice. He goes to sleep. He doesn't do it. So it's quite interesting how he goes from one state of mind to he gets puffed up with pride. So, the ego is a very interesting, isn't it? Very interesting beast. It's not really a beast, but you can swing from one emotion to another, from this kind of depth of despair to thinking, I could sort that out pretty quickly. Anyway, obviously it doesn't work. So his teacher says, this is not working. I'm going to send you to Marpa the translator with whom you have a karmic connection. And Milarepa's response to this is very, very interesting. He says, on hearing the name of Marpa the translator, my mind was filled with inexpressible feelings of delight. And a thrill went through my whole body, setting in motion every hair, while tears fell out of my eyes. So strong were the feelings of faith aroused within me. I therefore set out with the single purpose of finding this guru, carrying only a few books and provisions. So obviously something, we'll talk about this later when I come on to Milarepa and Marpa next week, but there is obviously a karmic connection. He just hears Marpa's name and, he has this kind of very strong feelings of faith. So he's gone from suffering and an understanding of karma to this, and with this karmic connection, to feelings of faith and a sense of purpose. It's a bit like Anatta Pindaka, isn't it? He hears the word Buddha, and he can't wait to go and meet the Buddha. So Milarepa, yes, he's got this karmic connection, so he sets off to meet Marpa. And meanwhile, Marpa and his wife both have significant dreams about Naropa, their teacher. So Marpa knows something's going to happen. He sets off to plough his field, which he never does. His wife says, what are you doing that for? Don't do that. You've got other people to plough your field. He says, I'm going to plough my field. Get me 3 jars of chang to take with me. Thirsty work ploughing. So eventually Milarepa, after a long journey, turns up. And although he doesn't know who Marpa is, and Marpa doesn't reveal who he is, he still has a kind of emotional response to this person that he meets. And Marpa says he can effect an introduction to himself later, and later they meet. So Milarepa tells Marpa that he's a great sinner and what he's done, and he offers body, speech and mind to Marpa. So this is important, he offers himself body, speech and mind to Marpa, and asks for food, clothing and instruction. So Marpa says, well, you can have the food and clothing and go and get the instruction elsewhere, or you can have the Dharma with me and get your food and clothing somewhere else. So he chooses to get the Dharma from Marpa and shift for himself, as it were. So Milarepa is very happy. He's met this great teacher, enlightened teacher, with whom he has a karmic connection. And now he hopes to receive instruction in the Dharma and initiation so that he can get on with this practice to gain enlightenment in this life so he can sort his very bad karma out. But sometimes things get worse before they get better, don't they? I don't know if you find that. It's certainly been my experience in life. So we've done unskillful things, and we feel remorse, and maybe in our own experience, that provokes us to search for something. We find the Dharma, and we learn to meditate, and we start to practice. But our mind is troubled. Meditation kind of allows us to go deeper into ourselves, into our emotions, into our motivations, people say, don't they, things come up, as it were, so the things from a deeper level arise into our consciousness that we've maybe tried to keep buried or not look at too much because it's so painful. So we see the things that we've done, which have caused us pain anyway, in a different light, and it can feel even more painful. Seems not fair, really, doesn't it? But it's because you've got a different perspective on it, you've got a more ethical perspective, You acted in ignorance then and you tried to repress your feelings. Now you're trying to let it all be in consciousness, as it were. So it can be very, very painful, and sometimes it's very hard to sit down and get into dhyana. Lots of other things we maybe need to do first. However, I think meditation, often people learn meditation first, don't they? Come to a centre, learn to meditate, acts retrospectively on our ethical sensitivity. So we do kind of understand more deeply what we've done and what we need to do to work with that. And that reminds me of someone called Jimmy Boyle. I don't know if you've heard of a man called Jimmy Boyle. He was a Glasgow hard man. He was put in Barlinnie maximum security prison for murder. He says he didn't do it. Maybe he didn't. I mean, he did other things. And he's written a play and a book about it, very interesting, called The Pain of Confinement. So he's in maximum security prison a long time, solitary confinement a long time. He's so unresponsive, they put him in a cage. He so doesn't want contact with anybody, he covers himself in his own excrement, so nobody can go near him. So he's end of the line, really. And somehow, I can't quite remember how this happens, but some enlightened person decides he's a good candidate for rehabilitation wing, the new venture that they're doing. So they put him in a sort of open prison. He's got a psychiatrist. And he writes about how, what it feels like to be trusted. You have a pair of scissors, he's doing parcels or something. So that's one of the things he writes about. And he gets to go out after this long, terrible period. And also he begins to give birth to self-reflexive awareness, or a greater self-reflexive awareness and a greater sensitivity. His conscience, his ethical sensitivity begins to develop. And you might think, well, that's great, isn't it? But actually he writes about how extremely painful that is. It's so painful to him to realise what he's done, who he's been, what he's done, that he's in despair. He's suicidal. He has to be on suicide watch. So, as a modern person, he's not a Buddhist, and he's a great guy, he helps young offenders, happy ending, married a psychiatrist, a song about it, Actually, I think they're divorced now, but anyway. but that, that really struck me when I read the book and when I saw the play, that yes, you just don't go from thinking, oh, I did that and that was not very good, to being, fine. There's this kind of, can be a very, very painful experience. So this happens, Mirapa thinks, he does feel remorse, and he's killed 35 people, he's destroyed the crops in the village, he feels remorse, he's in great fear from, his understanding of karma, which is perhaps quite hard for us to understand, that he really does believe that if he doesn't get enlightened in this life, he is going to go to hell realms for a long time. Not forever, but for a very long time. So he's desperate for the teachings, to sort of get going, as it were. And Marpa understands that that isn't yet possible. It's not yet possible. Somewhere it says that he's this broken, anguished man that comes to Marpa. He's not ready to learn to meditate or have the teachings that are going to help. He needs to be purified, and this is Marpa's task, as it were. So Marpa has a kind of understanding of the person who comes to him. They've got this karmic connection, very strong connection. And Marpa sets him the ordeals, the tasks. So I think this is very famous part of the story, is Mirapa building the towers and taking them down again. And so Mirapa repeatedly asks for the teachings, and Marpa, this is a refrain that runs through this story at this point, says something like, well, I went to India, I've been to India twice, which is a long journey from Tibet to India, a great hardship for Marpa. And I brought the teachings back, with great pains, and I gave all my gold to get them. Do you think you're just going to, you think you're going to just get it just like that? So this is a sort of refrain that Marpa gives to poor old Mirapa. So, you're not ready for, how about building some houses for my son? So they're obviously of a ritual nature, because he starts to build them, and he has to take them down. So he starts to build a circular one, a crescent-shaped one, a triangular one, the square one, and they're built in the four directions of the compass. So you have a sense that it is a ritual that he's getting Mirapa to do. He's building, for one thing. He's not, he's building, destroying, but he's building. And it's like a mandala, isn't it? It's like the stupa. It's got all that kind of implied in it, although Mirapa doesn't know this. So every time he gets quite a long way with each house, Marpa comes along and says, what have you done that for? That's not what I wanted. Take it down. Return all the stones and start again. Oh, I was drunk when I asked you to do that. a bit more Chang. I was drunk when I asked you that. Take it all down again. I must have been out of my mind when I asked you to do that. What are you doing? Take it all down again. So, Milarepa, you know, takes them all down. And very, very hard. He starts, you know, it's all, you know, it's great big stones on his back to build these towers. And he starts to get sores on his back, terrible sores on his back. Now, Marpa's wife has a soft spot for Milarepa. She's like the good mummy in the piece. And she's always trying to sort of intercede and help Milarepa. So she kind of says to Marpa, look, you know, he's got these terrible sores. And Marpa's always, well, you know, I had to go through, I had to, you know, I was in India with Milarepa, I had to do this, that, and the other, next thing. Tell him to put a pad on them. You know, so you get a sort of backstage kind of different view of Marpa, where he obviously does care, but he's tough with Damema and he's tough with Milarepa. And while Milarepa's building these houses, and he keeps thinking, you know, he's going to get the Dharma all the time, and Milarepa's always moving, Marpa's always moving the goalposts, other people come and have initiations, which he desperately wants. He wants the Dharma. So Damema's always trying to get him into the initiation. You've got to have a fee. You've got to pay for your initiation. He's got nothing. So she borrows things and gives him things that are hers or Marpa's or somebody's to get him in. And of course, Marpa's not fooled. You know, where did you get that from? That's not yours. That's mine. Out. Kicks him out. Beats him, it says. And, you know, each time Milarepa is in despair, he's unhappy, he's suicidal. I mean, it's very strong stuff. So Marpa says things like, just because you've moved a few clumps of mud, you think I must give you the teachings that I obtained. There's so much personal sacrifice and cost. If you can pay, okay. If you can't, get out. So this just goes on and on. But he does at some point, I mean, I think he's kind of... Marpa's very sort of sensitive to Milarepa's states. At some point, he does give him the refuges and precepts. So it gives him some hope. But Damema's always trying to sort of, you know, get him what he needs. And they cook up this plan where Milarepa's going to sort of pretend to leave home, you know, in Marpa's view. So, you know, he packs up his stuff and Marpa just doesn't fall for it. He just drags him back and, you know, gives another beating and... etc. And Milarepa says, my heart was pierced with grief. My heart was pierced with grief. As well, I was awed by Marpa. So there's a kind of interesting relationship we are going to explore later. And he weeps and he thinks, you know, my prayers, my entreaties, my stratagems, none of them are going to work. So he sort of has hope. And then he has despair, doesn't he? And, you know, his faith. He keeps having faith in Marpa, and then he loses it. And so it's very, very difficult for him. And Marpa, you know, from Milarepa's point of view, is just angry, cross, throwing him out, not giving him what he wants. And sometimes he sulks. He puts his cloak over his head and seems to sulk. So eventually, Milarepa is... he can't bear it any longer. He's tried everything, and with Damema's help, she gives Marpa some very strong chang, and he falls asleep, and she steals Naropa's malas, which are very, very precious, and gives them to Milarepa and says, go to this disciple of Marpa's, and, he, you know, there's a letter and there's the reliquaries, you know, he'll give you the teaching. So off Milarepa goes, thinking he'll finally get the teachings, but it doesn't work. He, you know, the disciple gives him the teachings, but it doesn't work because he's given himself body, mind, and soul to Marpa. That's where the connection is. It doesn't work because he's sort of going behind Marpa's back. So Marpa is having another initiation, in which this disciple, I think he's called Ngukpa, I can't quite pronounce the Tibetan, is to come with all his kind of retinue and his disciples. So they all come to Marpa's, and he says, and bring that wretch, Milarepa, with you, he belongs to me. So they come, and you know, there's going to be a feast, there's going to be an initiation. And Ngukpa says, I've brought everything except one lame goat that I didn't bring with me. And Marpa says, you got to go back and get it. You got to go back and get that goat. So even, you know, this kind of disciple that is in good connection with Marpa, you know, Marpa is quite stern with. And he says it's to show that the Dharma has value. You know, you can't leave something behind. You have to bring even your lame goat. So eventually everybody's together. And So Milarepa, he's tried everything, really, and he's not received the Dharma. And he is on the verge of suicide. And I think it's Nagopa kind of sees this and goes to Marpa and says, oh, I think it's really serious. I think he is, he's in a bad place. And it says, Marpa becomes mild and calls everyone together and says, our chief guest is Great Sorcerer. This is his kind of nickname for Milarepa, so slightly ironic. Our chief guest is Great Sorcerer Milarepa. So finally, and you can read the full story in the life, it's much longer, the whole building of the towers and the taking them down and so on and so forth. There's one bit in the building of the towers, particularly kind of where Marpa's, Milarepa's right, he's on the last tower, I think, and people help him with the foundation stone, and Marpa's promised that he won't ask him to tear it down. But when he comes to inspect it, he says, did you put that stone there by yourself? And Milarepa says, no, I had some help. So he says, take it down, start again. So it has been very, very tough on Milarepa. But at this point, Marpa calls everyone together and says, our chief guest is Great Sorcerer, is Milarepa. I'm going to give him the Dharma. And he says, it's quite interesting, he says, no one is to blame. Dameima is not to blame. She has more than usual maternal sympathy. She sympathised with Milarepa. So who can blame her that what she did was serious? Because he's kind of chased her and asked her to bring the malas back and stuff, and she's locked herself in a cupboard or something. Nagopa's not to blame. He didn't know that Milarepa wasn't coming to him in a true way. Milarepa's not to blame because he's used every means to get the Dharma. It's kind of shown his character. He says, I'm not to blame. I'm not to blame. I was bound by duty to fill Great Sorcerer with despair. And that's very interesting. I was bound by duty as his teacher to fill Great Sorcerer with despair. Anger recoiled upon me. So that's interesting. So he's expressed all this kind of fierceness, and it's, though it's not that it hasn't had an effect on him. Anger recoiled upon me. But it's not worldly anger. Again, don't try this at home, children. Ours probably is. It was to excite repentance in Milarepa, to contribute to the spiritual, to his spiritual development. I wanted to plunge him 9 times into despair, and if I had, he would have been cleansed thoroughly. But he's had 8 deep tribulations and many minor chastenings, and has cleansed many major and minor sins. So now I'm going to care for him and give him the teachings and food, and enclose him in meditation, so let's all rejoice. So there's joy, delight, weeping, obeisances, a party, mochang probably, initiations and so on. And he gives Milarepa the name Mila Dorje Gyaltsen, Mila Diamond Banner. And he becomes a lay brother with the Bodhisattva precepts. So I am going to next week kind of explore this relationship, Marpa and Milarepa, a bit more, because we probably think, that's a bit tough, isn't it? Sometimes we think our ordination process is a bit tough, isn't it? But hey, rejoice, it's not as bad. It seems very, very harsh to us, isn't it? And, violent and abusive. It is, isn't it? So, what are we going to... Well, think about it, until next week, what you think about it. At one point, Marpa does say to Milarepa, this kind of treatment, which is, happened down the line to Lopa to Naropa and Naropa to Marpa, is not going to be suitable for your disciples. So Milarepa isn't like this with his own disciples. He's not challenging, but he's not like this. But Marpa must have thought, as an enlightened person, it was necessary. This is the means he used to cleanse Milarepa of that dreadful, heavy karma. And as soon as it's done, he's compassionate and kind to Milarepa. It's not a kind of thing that he just carries on doing. He lets it go, as it were. So he's tested. He obviously thought Milarepa needed to be purified and tested, his faith and endurance tested. Because he's going to be given some very intensive practice. He's going to meditate the rest of his life in caves. So he needs to be strong. He needs to have a lot of faith. And it does seem as though he felt Milarepa needed to be sort of plunged into this despair to really, really understand the nature of what he'd done, to be completely purified of it. It's interesting that he doesn't even think that Milarepa can start with purifying meditation practices. And he does the Vajrasattva practice later. He does the confession practice later. But at this point, he just needs to do this. He needs to build and endure and be purified. So I'm going to sort of end at this point. I'm going to come back next week to a little bit more of the life and then discuss Milarepa's relationship with Marpa and then talk about Milarepa's ability to endure hardship and take hardship on the path and to do that with joy. So I'm just going to end with this quote of Marpa saying to Milarepa, "It was to cleanse your sins that you had to work so hard on the four houses, which are similar to the four types of action, four types of tantric action. I purposely wanted to fill your heart with bitter repentance and sorrow, verging on despair. And you bore all these trials with patience and faith. So you will have worthy disciples yourself. And so my guru encouraged, praised and gladdened me, and my happy days began."